Very quickly, we'll start off with providing the economic overview, our current state of affairs, then look at our the actual departmental performance, and then we'll look at the incentives, and then we'll look at our financial performance and audit report. Very briefly, all these predictions, there was at the beginning of the year predictions for quite positive growth, both globally, on the continent, in emerging markets, and in the country. But as you know, the world has become a much more difficult place. Growth is erratic. Growth is slowing down in China. The U.S. is putting up interest rates. So South Africa is caught in a double whammy now, where, as you know, our commodities are affected by Chinese growth, and also our financial markets are affected by U.S. Interest rates and tight monetary policy. So, as I said, I won't spend too much time on the global economy. Safe to say that things are difficult, and we have to watch things day by day. Within the local economy, as you can see, again, growth is erratic, but there is, as I said, a positive, we are starting to turn the corner. There are very strong indicators. Honourable Chair, I saw you there at the investment conference, and as you can see, there at least the mood amongst business is changing. There's a bit more confidence in the economy, but also the reports from the Reserve Bank show that there's a positive move even in consumer confidence. So hopefully with those two factors, we should see a rebound in the economy. Again, unemployment, we are still facing, still our biggest challenge. Unemployment is increasing, and that's because whilst we are creating about 200,000 jobs a year, the labor force is still growing at 300,000, much higher than our ability to grow. But as I said, when growth and investment picks up, hopefully we will start seeing an improvement. Manufacturing jobs the same. As you know, we are in a strong position where we have at least about 1.7 million people employed in manufacturing. So it remains a substantial employer of high-paid jobs in the economy, but as you can see, it is also fluctuating. And the biggest problem in manufacturing is on the demand side. Both business and consumers are spending less, and then the recent oil prices and VAT has depressed consumer spending, which means people are not buying their motor vehicles, their products they used to, and therefore that is constraining the economy. But as I said, with a turnaround in consumer confidence and business spending, we do expect a rebound in the new quarter. The one positive news, Honorable Chair, with the economic overview is the trade deficit. As you know, with all emerging markets like Turkey, others, we are vulnerable to what they call twin deficits, both a budget deficit and a trade deficit. Fortunately, our trade position is improving year by year, and it was even covered by the governor, that we are slowly, in terms of trade, we are starting to show a positive trade balance. And as you can see, the red lines there, the red lines indicate our exports, and the blue line indicates our imports. And as you can see, in the early days, the blue line was always on top, which means we were importing more than we exporting. But as you can see, the red line is slowly getting back, and that is really positive for the country once our trade balance improves. So that's what I call the fundamentals. I'll show you positive signs. Again, the BRICS, and we had a discussion earlier. As I said, we need to move rapidly to improve our trade balance with the BRICS countries. While we think we're showing positive growth with the European Union, with the continent, with the BRICS, there's still work to be done in terms of trade. I'm not going to spend any time on this. Safe to say our primary objectives is twofold, is industrialization and transformation. So in the report following, we will look at how are we doing in those two critical areas. Then, of course, our third area is regulations, and then we will deal with those ones. Then starting with industrial development, again, on some of the positive trends, the first one is that is that really if we look at the automotive industry and the component sector, we again see very positive growth, and I think our auto sector is ready for going to another level. Over the 10-year period and in the last financial year, the trends continue. 8 billion investment in the previous year, but 45 billion over a 10-year period. All the major vehicle manufacturers are expanding and reinvesting, from Mercedes-Benz, Toyota, Volkswagen, BMW, Ford, Beijing Automotive Works, and the very positive news is, as you know, General Motors withdrew in Port Elizabeth, but Isuzu has come in, the Japanese truck manufacturer and commercial vehicle manufacturers. They are very positive, and they are expanding their plants, so Isuzu has made a good comeback. And then the other sectors where we've seen positive progress is in the clothing, textile, leather, and footwear sector through our incentive program. And there we've managed to maintain the 95,000 jobs, but also we've seen some growth, you will see later on. In the leather sector, over the period, 22 new factories have been opened up, which is very rare for the sector, and especially Pietermaritzburg and those areas in KwaZulu-Natal were very strong in the Eastern Cape as well. In the footwear sector, they've been covering their jobs there. The other sectors which are showing positive progress is boat building. And then again, maybe on the not-so-positive side is on the procurement and the localization. As you know, because of corruption, the massive benefits we were supposed to see from 1,600 1,064 locomotives. Unfortunately, because of corruption in the supply chain, we are not seeing the benefits of that program. But in the other parts, like Aberdeen, we see progress in bus manufacturing, but not in locomotives. Further carrying on with in the industrial development and transformation, as you know, the Black Industrialist program is now taking shape. We're starting to showcase our key Black industrialists. In total, the program has produced over 100 Black industrialists, or we supported over 100. And these are the ones we've just highlighted because we're trying to really give prominence to Black industrialists. We have our minister or deputy minister going to showcase the big ones. So we visited, we went to Manili Pet Foods in Sabenza in Gauteng. We went to Limpopo with Derso Alljoy. We came down to the Western Cape here with K9, and we went to KZN as well to launch some of these projects. Then turning to the global stage, and especially our trade and investment front, I think the biggest achievement in the past year has been the work, and which you will deal with later, is South Africa joined the Continental Free Trade Area, and as I said, already 22 countries have signed, so at least there is positive momentum in terms of integration of the continent. I won't spend any time on this one because that will be the next presentation on the CFTA. But just to say, we have active programs to help our companies to break into the export market. So we have, for example, a global exporter passport program. This is where we give training to companies, and we trained over 844 countries, well above the target of 640. We also, as you know, we do trade exhibitions. South Africa won the Best Exhibitor Award in Chile at that trade exhibition. And overall, we provided companies with leads, which our foreign economic representatives and others, we identified trade opportunities, and that amounted to over 5 billion rand compared to a target of 3 billion. This is also just for the quarterly basis, how much companies we trained and how much leads we provide to companies in the export market. Again, on the positive side is now the special economic zones. We've seen good progress. Unfortunately, it's only confined to a few areas now, but we see at least some of the more established SEZs are taking off. Kuha is London. We've moved now to 84 investors in our zones, and the number of direct jobs has now moved from 10,000 to 13,900. So there is progress. As you will see in the full report, we are slowly moving to cover the whole country with our SEZ. We are in the final stages of Mpumalanga's SEZ, and then there's two in the pipeline, which is Northern Cape and Northwest, and then we will have a special economic zone in every province. Also, we are helping the special economic zones with marketing, so we arrange a SEZ investment roadshow to China, to Guangzhou, in May this year, and we are regularly now getting all the SEZs to work together as a team South Africa in promoting all our zones. Also, moving on to the transformation front, the only point to highlight here is that we are making more use of what we call the equity equivalent program. This is where the big multinationals, we are asking them to participate by training, by creating opportunities in their supply chain for BE enterprises, skilling of students and so on. So through these multinationals, we've done some with nine multinationals, including the latest one, Caterpillar, and now very recently we've also done Amazon, and Chair, you saw them at the investment conference. They're also going to be making a big investment, as you know, as the world's second biggest company, Amazon Web Services. They are establishing some big operations in the country, and they will be doing lots of training, and they'll also be introducing black entrepreneurs into the supply chain. Going further with our trade missions, we're also providing opportunities to our black industrialists to participate. We took 9 black industrialists to Namibia, then 7 to Uganda, and then also, again, 9 black industrialists to Mozambique. This is, again, promoting export opportunities for our black industrialists, and I can report that a number of them have managed to obtain orders and new contracts on these trade missions. And then the other part of our special economic zone transformation program is our industrial park revitalization. We completed 12 industrial parks. We spent over 229 million, and then we held the launches in Amanskraal, in Babalehi, and in Ulindlela, in Itata. This program has also become part of the President's stimulus package, and we are pleased now that this program can take off so that we can cover more and more industrial parks close to our townships, and we really need to create employment closer to where people live. And then as we move towards conclusion, legislation and regulation, Chair, this is also an area where Select Committee plays a very active role, and we want to thank you for the support we've got so far. The most important ones currently before, which we've been working on, we've taken through cabinet public consultation processes during the financial year, but it's the national gambling and the liquor policy areas. And as you know, Chair, the social effects of excess gambling and the question of liquor is having an effect on our society, and that is why we are hoping that we can still proceed with the gambling legislation. That is just to tighten up some of the excesses, so and the decision-making process in gambling. But we also did the credit life insurance regulations. Then turning to administration and coordination, as you know, our biggest target is the small businesses. So we've obviously set a trend about paying within 30 days. We can report again 100% of DTI's invoices are paid within 30 days, and actually the bulk of them are paid within 15 days, and we've developed a system there which we are advising the rest of government to prioritize this area. Also, we've managed to finally make it clear to break the barrier with regards to women's empowerment in our senior management services, and we have now hit the target of 51% women in our, and then again, we've maintained our track record with regards to employing persons with disabilities. Just looking very broadly, because you've always asked us to focus on evenly across the provinces, so we've given a breakdown of our incentives across the provinces, and as you can see, while there is now a better dispersal than we was a few years ago, obviously it still reflects the business and industrial activity in the provinces, because it is demand-led, where companies apply, but we, as I said, once we do get applications from provinces that don't normally apply, we do fast-track those applications, and we go the extra mile to support that. Then turning to our financial performance, again, here, just to say that we our budget of 9.3 billion, we've, the bulk of that budget goes to incentives and to companies that employ people, 5.4 billion. Then we also have, obviously, the agencies that we have to support, from the National Consumer Commission to ECIC, but we've spent 99% of our allocated budget. And this is just a five-year trend of our expenditure patterns. As I said, we're keeping close to the target of ensuring that we don't underspend. And we utilize all the resources given to us by ourselves. And then finally, on the audit outcome, again, we are pleased to report that we have been able to maintain our clean audit record, in the past 4 years. We've received an unqualified opinion, no finding, which means there was no material misstatements. So that was maintained. I think that will... all remains is to be in the Western Cape, so I can say it was Kakulu or Bayadanki.
Thank you very much, DG October.
Honourable members, there we have it. Maybe we just need to emphasize that this is the report for 2017-18. DG and your team, what you would find is when we engage with you, we won't limit ourselves to what has happened, but may even raise questions related to the present financial year, and we normally allow that to happen because we know there's sufficient capacities within the departments reporting to us to deal with those type of matters. Honourable members, it's open for questions and comments. I have quite a few, but I wanted to give you the floor first. We have the Honourable High from the Eastern Cape. I see they got more money than Gauteng in the last year.
Thank you very much. You see, that maybe we need to relook at the concentration of economic activity to Gauteng. Because you remember that during our pre-visit for taking Parliament to the people, we have challenges of migration in Gauteng as a result of that concentration. But if economic activity is to be spread throughout the country, that's how perhaps you would deal with this issue of migration. So perhaps it's good that we have more money than housing. In fact, we need to encourage that. firstly, let me say that normally with regard to APP and the annual report, we require the presence of the executive, especially with those two. That's what we said in the past, because they are the custodians of these records. But I know that we have not been able to do that with regard to this one. That's what the two highlights, so that it's a matter that can be taken up. with the executive, either the minister or the deputy minister. Remember in the APP, the deputy minister was present, but I think at least one of the executive members be present there. That's if I can just then to the question, perhaps let me start with the incentives that you referred. I wish that perhaps even if not now, maybe in writing, if we could have a breakdown of these incentives and their allocation per provinces. And perhaps also the status of particularly the automotive one. We went to, as the chairperson was saying, that it would also raise the current issues. We went to Toyota in Durban last month, and they were still not clear what is going to be the status of that incentive, given that it come to the end for this period. So they're not so clear if you can update us on that one, but also on the clothing one, because we also visited a clothing factory also in Durban, if you can clarify. But then generally, I would request if we could have the breakdown of all these incentives, what is it that you're giving to firms, rather than just the 10 billion for Eastern Cape, without clarifying which of these incentives these billions are coming from. So I wanted to suggest that. But also, also the breakdown, that could also be done in writing if we're not able to do now the breakdown on the black industry, the provinces. I just went to on the economic, well, economic outlook. What in domestically, what is the affecting the construction industry decline? I mean, given everywhere you go, there's construction that is taking place everywhere you go, whether it's houses or roads. But every now and then, we are always told that the construction industry is declining. To me, it doesn't make sense when I look at what is happening in the country. So if you can clarify that. The other issue is the FEZ Act came into operation in 2016, 16 of February 2016. And in terms of the transitional arrangement, it should take 3 years from IDZ to FEZ. And February next year, I think there will be a completion of that 3 years. How far are those IDZ in terms of transitioning now full to becoming a FEZ? I'm not sure if you still allow me there. Okay. We, as also indicated, we visited a small enterprise in Durban. One of the issues that they were relating to us in terms of them being unable to make it at the requirement of SABS. So we expect that departments like there should be an integrated approach, but there will be one entity of government that is assisting SMMEs, but then you have another entity of government being a stumbling block. Meaning there is no integrated approach in the development of SMMEs. So if you can touch on that. I think we're still coming to the issue, but that's on the tripartite argument. You know, the chair presented a report in the plenary, and that was ratified by the plenary. But the report indicated that there were 26 countries, but 22 signed. That was a long time ago, but we still remained on the same number. So what's happening with regard to the progress with regard to this issue? The last two, the 28,000 jobs if we could have a provincial spread on that one, and the projected jobs of 15,000 new jobs. If we could have this. And also the MCEP grant, if we could also have the very, very last note is in the budget of the department, what constitutes the say for the SMMEs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable High. Because of the number of questions, I've allowed him because of the number of members that there are. But can we, Honorable Mutanga, would you be in agreement that we give the department an opportunity to respond on those before you raise yours? Is it okay with you, Honorable? Okay, if you feel that way, I will allow you. Just allow me to make two comments, TJ. The one is you referred us to the full report. Now, some of the things that the Honorable High raises might be in that report. I have not seen it yet. That's fine. But we need to get someone who will take responsibility to make sure that that report gets to all the members. Shubeka, is that you or Saroj? Because she's pointing at you. It's you and Mafit. Do you have copies in your office? Oh, it's at the papers office. Martins, can you see if we could get it delivered today or tomorrow? Okay, so that would then answer some of the things, so you don't need to go into detail on that necessarily, DG. My second thing is just I have to admit that I have defaulted, that I didn't allow you the opportunity to do apologies, because you mentioned the executive members. Maybe if you could start off with explaining exactly where they are. Thank you.
The actual report.
Sorry.
In any way, say you that it maybe I was going to be covered in any way. That was one of my first clarification questions, according to the honourable member here, because yes, when we present this, we believe that the Borotan principal was here, the minister. So that when there are questions on political issues, they can answer, because you can't answer those political issues. But there are another question, Chair, perhaps, to add on the industrial park. I think it's like, I don't know, industrial park on slide 20. I just wanted clear clarity on one industrial park in Gangala, Highveld Park. What is happening with that park? Because it was declared by the legislature, I think your department as an industrial park. There's no progress. They say people will be end up being invading that land because there's vast open land there, and there's no activity that is happening. Although there are companies that are appointed to monitor and then do all the repairs and so on. What is the progress there? Are we seeing it progressing? Is that in the park going to be utilized as planned? In regard to your skills and so on in that area, because there's much shortage of skills on your mining industry and heavy industry. What is the progress around there? And perhaps, Chair, to come to another question on the very same question on your provincial incentive. I think I will follow the tune from the previous speaker here, the latter speaker. In Mpumalanga, we are saying you approved this, what you approved here. I also need breakdown on the job created. And the projects, where are these projects in Mpumalanga? I think it will, of course, assist us to then, when we speak with our constituencies, we are able to then say, there is the... I think that will be okay. The other one, Chair,
details on the funding. You have a financial performance. You are saying you have 2.2 billion, that is page 34. 2.2 billion, which is 23.61% that are transferred to. I just want details on this, the breakdown in terms of the money of the value itself. How did you break it down? The funding itself, where did it go? What are the foresights? Are we achieving in terms of the actual purpose of this funding? Thank you,
Chief.
Thank
you.
Thanks. Just on the question of the executive, firstly, in terms of the minister, he's given his apologies. Actually, he just landed this morning, or he should be at the airport now. He's come back from China. China had a massive, for the first time, they're having an import expo where we took companies there, and because he was also representing the president in China. And then he has to go straight into cabinet because actually one of the questions you asked about the auto program, it is currently before cabinet as we speak. And then our deputy minister is booked off ill, and he has a doctor's appointment as well this morning. Then I think as you suggested, Honourable Chair, we will then give you in writing a detailed breakdown on exactly the spending, the specific incentives for each province, and where possible we'll give you the company's details as well where we can for the breakdown, and then that can assist you for as I said, for both Mpumalanga and Eastern Cape as well. So I'm not going to then go into the incentives in any detail. As I indicated with regards to Honorable High's point about automotives and clothing and textiles, as I said, that program is really important to us because we've developed a new plan and we've reached consensus with the industry on a new plan till 2035, which will give them certainty. And that, as I said, is currently before cabinet, and if I could appeal to members to assist us to where you have influence to really support that program, because as I said, we're going to be start delivering the jobs now, both in the clothing one and the automotive. All of them have promised double production and double employment by 2035, and many of them are moving in that direction. Then we'll also give you a breakdown of the Black Industrialists grants, which we've done. So we do have that readily available. You've touched a very clear issue, which is the construction industry. And as you say, I've been thinking the same thought as I drive through all the provinces. I see cranes everywhere. But then, as I said, in terms of the stats, it's almost a year that the construction industry has been in recession. And the reason for that is mainly all of the government and especially the SOEs have stopped spending. So as you know, we are driven a lot by Eskom, Transnet, Prasa. Those parastatals make up a big part of spending. They've stopped spending because of the spending. And as you know, Keynes talked about something called the paradox of savings. People usually think it's good to save, but it's bad for an economy if you don't spend. So government spending needs to pick up. Parastatal spending needs to pick up. And then, as you know, business spending needs to pick up. But as I said, there's been a slight recovery over the last quarter, especially with business spending. And some municipal spending, but that's the big problem. And municipalities also are not spending because of their problems. So that is our biggest challenge. Once we can get that going, then, as I said, that creates a mood of confidence. In terms of the Special Economic Zone Act, yes, I'm pleased to report now, as you correctly say, there was a three-year transition period. All of the ACZs are now on track to complete their transition or successfully. We've also just met with your, especially your province. You've got the most successful special economic zones. Both Kuka and ID and East London have turned the corner, doing extremely well. And they are, and we also met with them recently with the MEC as well. And we finalized that how for them to be compliant with that. And as I said, they were on track to do so. As I said, we hope we can get more progress on the Wild Coast SEZ, but Port St. John's, because I think that's the remaining one. On turning to Mpumalanga and Kangala, I'm going to ask my colleagues to maybe give you a bit more detailed report, but definitely we are prioritizing. We are, as I said, they've completed the public consultation on the Comas SEZ. That is going to cabinet, that will be in the, hopefully the final cabinet meeting of the year. We will finalize that, but also the industrial parks, we're giving high priority to that, and Seneca will report on that, but it is positive. We are working very closely with the province on that. On South African Bureau of Standards, I think we noted the problem there. We have made an intervention here, and we have requested again because of the issue. As you know, we have seconded Garth Strachan to do a turnaround plan for Bureau of Standards. And as I said, he is proceeding well there. And hopefully we will be resolving all the issues at Bureau of Standards. I think I'll leave over the issue of the tripartite, and maybe Kholewa can just touch on that when she presents the next presentation. And then Honourable Mhlanga, on the finances, I'm going to ask the CFO to maybe just say a few things around that. And then I think we'll be able to conclude.
Thank you. Okay, Tineka Yansma, I'm standing in for DDG Sipozivote for SZ and ET. In Mpumalanga, we are working with Mega and currently working with three industrial parks, Ika Industria, Siyabuswa, and Kapowe. The Highveld, the steel area, the Highveld Industrial Park was brought to our attention. We're still scoping it and looking at the requirements that will be needed there.
Thanks, Shabir.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Shabir Khan. I'm the CFO at the Department of Trade and Industry. Honourable Member, if I could perhaps maybe just also refer you to page 233 of the annual report. That does have a... don't have one. Okay, but what I would say is that the transfer payments budget of DTI includes transfers to all our entities, such as the National Gambling Board, Consumer Commission, SABS, ECIC. So all those are transfer payments. Also included in the transfer payment budget is our incentive program. And once again, it's just a classification in terms of the accounting standards. And then the last transfer is any transfer to any foreign bodies. We do pay membership fees to the WTO, to the World Bank for some of the programs. So those are all the transfers. But the detailed breakdown is on page 233, 234, 235, 236, and 237 of all the transfers made by the department. Thank you.
Just finally, is the question of the share of small and medium enterprises in our support. As I said, we don't have a precise breakdown, but as you know, especially the clothing, textile, and footwear scheme, where we've helped over 1,000 enterprises there, 90% of them are small businesses in the clothing, textile, and footwear industry. And then also, as you know, with regard to autos, there's a very dynamic relationship between big and small firms. So the seven OEMs they, whilst they are large enterprises, like you've been to Toyota, the small companies supply the components, and especially the second and third tier suppliers. And so as we grow the auto industry, we are growing a lot of small businesses into that, and we'll be able to maybe give a breakdown of that in more detail. But that is how we'll be supporting small businesses. But every sector has both a small business and large businesses, and as we support the sector, we like, for example, in autos, the big push now is higher local content. And as they create more local content, they a small business that will be supplying the inner panels of the cars, the carpets, the small businesses do play that role.
We comment. Honorable Ntebe, do you want to come in now? You're okay. Before you, Honorable Hai, just allow me to raise just three, then I'll end the others. The one is related to the National Empowerment Fund. DG, can you provide us with a status report on the recapitalization of the NAF? My second question is related to SAPS, but a completely different one. You have budgeted 285 million towards SAPS, but the annual report states that you spent 302 million. Can you explain to us, with all the difficulties that we're having with SAPS, that particular increase in the transfer? My third question is related to the SEZ, and there's going to be two components in that question. The one is that you have underspent 12.2% on the SEZ, and then you have environment of 9.4 million from the SEZ to other programs. We need to just have an understanding why that has happened. Then related to that, my B part of that SEZ, IDZ question is what I've raised with the Raj, and I'm still waiting on a clear response on that, which is the industrial development area bordering Gauteng and Northwest, which is there in the Harankuwa area. I've had a black businessman from that area complaining that if they go to Northwest, they are told that, no, you're not our responsibility. And if they go to Gauteng, they have exactly the same dilemma. Now, with a full appreciation, that's why I gave Honorable Ntebe a chance to talk before me, but I've raised this with him as well, to say it's a difficulty there. I know, as you would know as well, that that area was developed as part of the apartheid era strategy of building industries within the Bantustan. But we are unapologetic as this government to say that if there are apologies, if there are opportunities for us to use those spaces for industrial development, we will indeed do so. So can you just help explain that to us? Then manufacturing circle. You are showing the decline in the manufacturing sector. Now, I participated in the annual events on the manufacturing in Durban. We're spending money on that as government. Can you tell us whether that is worth the money and energy that we're putting into that, and to what extent the manufacturing circle, as the private sector, is buying into the urgency of increasing the manufacturing potential of the country? Honorable Hai, do you want to add now?
I'm trying to look at the report from the legal services. I want to compare it with the report from the RSSA. It says something about the withdrawal of Companies Act, but I was was not able to check the legal services report, whether that bill is there or not. If you can just update us on that. The other one I wanted to check is this South African trade balance with BRICS. How are we going to turn that situation around? Thank you.
Honourable Chair, thanks and, for those very pointed questions. I think I'm going to kick off ask the CFO to just respond to your issue around the Bureau.
Thank you, DG. There was a requirement approved for approximately 17 million rand towards the South African Bureau of Standards. It was for the local content verification, which is to build capacity within SABS to assist government in verifying local content across the various government tenders. So that's the reason for the increase in the budget.
Thanks for that. Honourable Chair, on the NEF status, yes. As you know, because of the tight budget, Treasury did indicate to us that they cannot give any financial assistance to the National Empowerment Fund, and what they recommended was that we merge or we create a subsidiary. The NEF becomes a subsidiary of the Industrial Development Corporation because of their big balance sheet, that we use that, and in that way they can get capital to proceed. We have taken the we've then agreed a process. They've worked on a proposal to create for the National Empowerment Fund to become a subsidiary of the Industrial Development Corporation. That cabinet member that went to cabinet. Cabinet has sent us back, and we will be going to the last cabinet meeting with a revised proposal on that. But basically, cabinet asked us to be much more bold in terms of it must be a repositioning of the National Empowerment Fund, so that that we ensure that they don't just become submerged and just become a small subsidiary of the IDC, but it becomes it gets strengthened through the merger process. So the two CEOs and our division has been worked on a revised cabinet memorandum, and that will be tabled in the last cabinet meeting on the National Empowerment Fund. So hopefully we will come up with a strengthened National Empowerment Fund. On the question, I think you correctly then said on the special economic zones, the issue there is, as you know, we get an allocation for special economic zones, but the applications comes from the IDZ, and we work on a first-come, first-served basis, and this serves as an incentive for IDZ to be able to get an investor, domestic or foreign, and then once they bring us the investor, we then give them an incentive for that investor, and that works on the application basis. Unfortunately, as I said, we've been getting very strong applications from Kucha, is landed IDZ, Dubai Trade Port also doing very well, but the other SEZs have been very slow. And therefore, sometimes we have we don't have enough applications for them. So that is why sometimes we give approvals, but they do not bring the investor in. So that is why we have to do the allocations from that zone. But also, we've been using, because we wanted to prioritize your next question, which is the industrial parks. As you know, the industrial parks, because most of them were located in the former homelands, they have been the stepchildren. And we have unfortunately punished them twice, that there's insufficient resources. So we've reallocated SEZ funding, other funding to our industrial parks. And that is why we have these environments and so on. In time, we want to make them, they are also special economic zones, and they need to prioritize. Then turning to your question, you're right about some of them, because they fell under the old Maputo Tswana and our former homelands, they fall under, like Karankua falls under the Northwest Development Corporation, still manage them. But as I said, we've cut through the bureaucracy, And we've directly supported Harankua now. Similarly with Babalehi as well. It is also in falls under Tshwane Metro, which is giving no support because they're saying it falls under North, or the land belongs to Northwest. But as I said, we are convening a conference, and we are setting up an association of industrial parks. They're having their meeting next week. It's the second one where we are trying to get everybody to work together, the metro, the province, and so on, to just help the zone itself. But we will give special attention to the Harankua issue when we meet with them next week, and to resolve any problems. The final issue is then about Honorable Khai on the amendments to the Companies Act. Yes, we have. We are proceeding with some technical amendments, and we've taken it through Cabinet. It has been approved. It's just now in terms of the parliamentary schedule, which is very tight. But we are hoping to, we've put it out for public comment so that we can get in, and then if we don't do it by this year, the next parliament will hopefully deal with the company law amendments. Again, Honourable Chair, on your question about manufacturing, yes, I think what we can say is that we've built a strong partnership with the manufacturing circle. They actually, the minister about, I don't know, about almost 10 years ago, he did say that if we're going to build a strong manufacturing sector, business must organize itself. And therefore, I think we really support the manufacturing circle. The performance, as you know, is, within anything, there's supply side and demand side. We have now created, quite through our support measures, companies have made the investment in the technology, in the upgrades of their plant and equipment. But as you know, the problem is now the people need to buy the products coming out of those factories. And unfortunately, the capacity utilization is running at 80%, which means the factories are there, but the demand is not there. And therefore, as I said, our key problem, and that is why the stimulus package and the job summit and the investment summit is to deal with the demand side. People need to spend more, and that is the problem on manufacturing. But I think, as I said, the export markets are picking up. We're exporting a lot. We've closed almost our trade balance with the European Union, so our companies are exporting, and a lot of it is autos. And machinery and equipment. The continent is picking up again, so our exports to the continent is picking up. So hopefully if domestic demand also picks up, which, as I said, the indications are there that it's starting again to happen. So hopefully in the next, maybe not the next quarter, but the following quarter, if we get export demand and domestic demand picking up, we should be able to recover the manufacturing sector, and we are poised for that. Honourable Chair, I think that covers the BRICS. Yeah, okay.
My name is Tolela Mubidida. I'll respond to the BRICS question. Yes, we do have a trade imbalance, which is in favour of the BRICS countries. The challenge is that we're mainly exporters of primary products, especially to the BRICS countries. At some point, we had a trade imbalance that was more or less the same as our total exports with China. But if you look at the figures, Honourable Member, you'll see that from 2015 to 2017, the deficit is decreasing, because what we have done is to, when we are engaging our BRICS countries, to promote value-added exports so that we change the structure of the trade. What we are also doing is to promote an investment-led trade strategy with the BRICS countries. Because what we've seen, especially with China, is that we have more investments in China than they have investments in South Africa. So we're encouraging the BRICS countries to invest in the country so as to increase the productive capacity and also ensure that we are able to benefit from the transfer of technology. So we have changed our strategy with the big BRICS countries. Also, when we hosted the BRICS summit, we
emphasize the point of fair to added trade, which is supported, and Brazil has also indicated that they will take forward that agenda. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Chair, if you allow me, maybe just the last one, if you can ask Mark Strachan just to, we've made a, as you asked about the SAMS payment which you picked up, we've also now made an additional transfer to Bureau of Standards because, as you know, there has been the laboratories and the testing equipment. They haven't reinvested for the past 20 years. So he has started the process to see that we start reinvesting back in the core business of SAMS. So if I could just give him 1 minute to just update the committee on the SAMS.
Thank you, DG, and thank you, Honourable Chairperson. The DTI deployed three administrators, the group operating officer, Jody Scott, the Chief Director of Technical Infrastructure, Dr. Chenge Dimane, and myself. On the instructions of the Minister and the Director General, we've undertaken a diagnostic analysis of the problems at the SABS, and those problems are multi-layered and deep, involving governance, institutional issues, management failures, policy problems, and operational problems. We have completed the diagnostic and an operational turnaround strategy. We have also, as the administrators, instituted immediate measures. That includes the reinstatement of so-called partial testing, otherwise known as customer-specific requirements or third-party testing, which had led to the loss of approximately 70 million rand revenue for the institution. And we've put in place a range of measures to ensure that the institutional and governance and oversight arrangements are properly in place, that there's proper alignment, policy alignment with the shareholder, the DTI, a process to ensure that there's a full suite of adequate policy measures, including performance management and HR policy frameworks, and measures to ensure that the institution is brought back up to speed with respect to operational issues. And part of this is to rebuild the stakeholder relations with the private sector, both with respect to standards, testing, certification, conformity assessment as a whole. We are confident that the process is well on track. Honourable Chairperson, as you will know, given the turmoil in the global trade regime and multilateral institutions, the issues of standards, testing, conformity assessment are going to assume an even greater importance in industrial policy and trade. And therefore, the second phase of the work which we are already embarking on is to ensure that we develop a longer-term strategy for the institution, working closely with the National Regulator for Compulsory Specification to ensure that a best practice ecosystem of standards, testing, conformity assessment, and compulsory specifications is put in place to protect and enable the manufacturing sector in an increasingly volatile and difficult global trade environment. That's a summary, Honourable Chair. We would obviously be available to give a much more detailed report.
Thank you very much. Honourable Members, I think we should move on. DG, can we just agree on a time frame on the questions that you will respond to in writing? We normally say 7 days. Mm-hmm. Next week, Wednesday, we can get them to Quebec's office. That's good. Honorable Khan, I want you to close the session.
Yeah. No. I was worried that we left Kaulan if they were talking to Bega to make so, oh, it's gone. But this issue that you've raised of NEF, I noted the response of DG with regard to that. We met with NEF, I think, this year. And the worrying part is that the CEO referred us to the State of the Nation address in, I think, in 2008 by former President Thabo Mbeki. I don't know if you can go back to that statement, DG. For me, had we stuck to that SONA presentation by the then president, I'm sure we would have been even far with regard to black industrialists. The commitment that was made in that particular statement by the former president and stick to it throughout the years. I'm sure with regard to black industrialists, they would have been far. So perhaps we need to go back to that statement and implement what was contained in that. So now, she was very, very worried because this is, for me, the platform, the real platform that can, you know, take black people far with regard to industrial development. I just wanted to make that point.
Thank you, Honorable High. Safe to say that all of us in this committee are anxious of what's going to happen vis-à-vis the recapitalization of the NEF, and also we are of one mind that the NEF has a vital role to play in the development of an inclusive economy in South Africa, and we want to have that recovered. Thank you very much to the DGI for that presentation. We have not brought you any accolades, as we have picked up on Facebook and also from Sidwell Nedupi about the different entities. We know you have 13 entities within DGI, and we did pick up in the media about the excellence in the performance and in the financial performance as well as the various departments. We just, as a committee, want to say, please request our staff within the department not to become lax now, but to continue to uphold that standard of performance. We note it with appreciation. Can we, with that said, go into the next report? I don't know which one you want to do first. There's the two agreements.
While
we're working on that, while you're setting up, let me say, honorable members, last week I was at a meeting of the heads of missions, and we had a very difficult question raised by the heads of missions with regard to the DGI deployees within embassies. It is a complicated matter. They are at the moment accountable to DGI. They are deployed by DGI, but they work with the ambassadors or with the heads of missions. And we also now have that new piece of legislation with regards to our international operations, and it may be a matter that the next administration would have to look at. So it applies to both DTI, but also to the Department of Tourism. If you have a person there, who is that person accountable to? Is it to another minister, or is it to the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation? There hasn't been clarity on that. My personal take on it was that it's the cabinet that must clear that. We're not going to, though I was there and these questions were raised, I felt I will hold my peace because cabinet would have to resolve that matter. But to just put it before you that we are not naive to that, it is a reality that we have to give attention to. DG, back to you.
Chair, thanks, and thanks for that. I think we move on then now. As I indicated, the next two presentations will be done by Colella. She's our Deputy Director General in charge of international trade, and I'll handle straight over to her.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'll start with the presentation on the AfCFTA. I won't go to the outline of the presentation, I'll just go straight to the issue. In terms of our approach to trade negotiations, Honourable Chair, we ensure that we support the development objectives that are set out in a number of policy documents of government, which include the National Development Plan, the New Growth Pact. But most importantly, we ensure that whatever we do with trade negotiations and trade agreements, it must support our industrial policy action plan and support the industrial development objectives of government. The aim is to ensure that we provide market access opportunities, especially for value-added products, because we want to ensure that through the trade agreements, we are able to create jobs in South Africa and are able to create new market access opportunities for products that are coming from our manufacturing sector. Especially in the multilateral trading system, GAF touched on this, the multilateral trading system is going through unprecedented challenges. And when it comes to global trade, we can see that there are trade tensions, especially between the U.S. and China. And what is clear is that what is targeted is no longer tariffs, but more the policy space. So in all our trade negotiations, we ensure that we do not unduly limit the development policy space that we need as a country. We get our mandate through intergovernmental consultations as well as consultations in NEDLAC. We engage especially business and labor to look at the implications of the commitments or tariff concessions that we are going to make vis-à-vis a third party and what it would mean for our own plans as a country. We are a member of a customs union, Honourable Chair, the Southern Africa Customs Union, which necessitates that we must negotiate together with our partners in SACU, which is Botswana, Eswatini, which used to be Swaziland, Lesotho and Namibia. This is important so that we protect the common external tariff. The focus areas of the trade agreement is mainly tariff concessions, which are mainly reciprocal. So we'll indicate in each of the tariff lines how we are going to treat that tariff line, which may mean reducing the duty to zero, or it may mean a margin of preference where you reduce by a specific margin. The other aspect of the trade agreement is the rules of origin. The rules of origin are the conditions the product must meet for it to get preferential access. So you would indicate that you need to have a specific component of the product being made
locally or regionally. So the aim of the rules of origin, or our approach to rules of origin, is to ensure that we promote the development of regional value chains, local sourcing, as well as promote industrial development in South Africa, but also in the rest of the region and the continent. We also ensure that the trade negotiations support our regional integration agenda. The main point I want to raise here is that I'm a member of a number of regional economic communities that we look up, who as I've indicated, then also the Southern Africa Development Community. We're a member of a free trade arrangement there. We also party to the tripartite free trade area between COMESA, SADC, and the EAC, and are also a signatory to the AFCFTA. What is the approach that we pursue when it comes to regional integration is a development-oriented approach, which combines market integration, which means the negotiation of free trade agreements within the continent, with infrastructure as well as industrial development. The aim of that agenda is to ensure that we're able to address the core challenges or constraints to intra-African trade, which are mainly the supply side constraints as well as productive capacity constraints. This issue is historical, because of colonialism, the continent was carved out into 55 smaller member states. And the infrastructure that we have is mainly about sourcing a specific mineral or agricultural product from a specific locality to the port for exports to the rest of the world. So it does not promote intra-African connectivity as well as intra-African trade. So that strategy, the development-oriented strategy, is well thought through to try and address those challenges. I won't go into the history, Honorable Chair, but we do indicate in that slide what is the history of regional integration. In terms of what the AFCFTA will do, the UNECA, which is the Economic Commission for Africa, which is a UN body, indicates that if we are to implement the CFTA, it will unlock intra-African trade and will grow it by 52% by 2022. Currently, we have intra-African trade that is standing at 18%. If you compare that with other regions globally, that is really low by global standards. And again, it's linked to the historical context that I've shared, that we are mainly suppliers of primary products to the rest of the world. But because of similar productive structures that we have, as well as the lack of interconnectivity internally, we are unable to grow intra-Africa trade, hence the development integration approach. If you look at Asia's intra-regional trade stands at 52%, North America 50%, the EU 70%. And if you look at our share of global trade, it's quite low at 3%. So what we are trying to do with the regional integration agenda is to change that. First, change the structure of our trade by promoting value-added trade and development of regional value chains, but also ensure that when we integrate into the rest of the global economy, we are able to move up the value chain, because being just suppliers of primary products means that we are not able to leverage the resources that we have. That slide shows the trend since 2000 up to 2015, so we have been able to double intra-Africa trade from 9% to 18%. The DG touched on this, South Africa is largest contributor to intra-African trade. We are having a trade surplus to the rest of the continent, and we have been able to grow our trade with the rest of the continent. And what is more important is that our exports into the continent, firstly, they are 30% of our global exports. Secondly, 63% of that is value-added export, which contributes directly to our industrial development objectives. The biggest trading partners in the region are Botswana, Namibia, Mozambique, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. We indicate the contribution to intra-African trade. If we look at our trade with the continent, just to unpack it a bit further, you will see, honourable members, that we trade more in the continent with SADC and SACCO. SACCO accounts for 43% of our intra-Africa trade, and the rest of SADC, including SACCO, accounts for 55%. All of this because of the preferential arrangements that we have with both regional economic communities. In SACCO, as a customs union, we have free movement of goods across the region. With the free trade agreement in SADC, we again have 99% of our goods access the market without paying any duty. So that is why we have been able to grow our exports into the region. However, we're not doing very well when it comes to trade with the other regions of the continent, which is why, maybe to respond to the point that was raised around the tripartite, we are working hard to ensure that beyond just the conclusion of the tripartite agreement, we are now moving closer to concluding, especially with the East African community, a preferential arrangement that will allow us to be able to have preferential access into the EAC. That will give us access to growing markets such as Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda. Now, we have, yes, 22 countries that have signed the TFTA out of the 26. Those that have signed are the countries that normally struggle to make the commitments because of where they are, whether it's politically or economically. So the countries that have not signed is Sudan, for example, because of the challenges that they have. You have Ethiopia that has not really committed to or fully to even the REC that it is participating in COMESA. It is not fully implementing its obligations there. You have Djibouti and Eritrea. So those are the countries that have not signed. But what they have indicated is that once they are able to sort out their own internal challenges, they are fully committed to the process, so we expect that over time they will be part of the TFTA. If we look at our exports to the region, as I said, honourable members, they are consisting of value-added products, machinery there, vehicles, plastics, fertilizers, sugars and confectionery, so it's both primary as well as value-added products. Now, coming to what are the objectives and features of the FCFTA. The main objective of establishing an FCFTA, which was launched on the 15th of June 2015 in South Africa in Johannesburg, is to create a single market for goods and services in the continent, which will facilitate that we are able to export our goods and services from South Africa right up to Egypt. It also ensures that we are able to harmonize trade regimes through progressive liberalization of tariffs and reduce the barriers to both goods and services. Most importantly, linked to the development integration agenda is to ensure that we work very hard towards the development of regional value chains so that we are able to increase productive capacity in the region and change the structure of trade. It's developmental in nature to take into account the fact that we have 36 LDCs which are in Africa. So you have small vulnerable economies, least developed countries, as well as developing countries. So you need to take into account the differences in levels of development. So there are provisions that have been put into the agreement to ensure that through the negotiations we can give flexibilities to especially least developed countries, both in terms of the commitments that they can make, but also in terms of the timing for them to be able to meet their commitments. Because we are establishing the AFCFTA, while we have at a regional level been progressing with our regional integration agenda, what we've agreed is that we need to preserve the acquis. What that means is that what already obtained at a REC level will continue. So the preferential trade arrangement we have in SACCO and the preferential trade arrangement we have in SADC will be maintained. So the AFCFTA would mean that we are going to negotiate as South Africa with countries that are in the AFCFTA that are not members of SADC, SACU, as well as the tripartite. So effectively, it means that South Africa will negotiate with the rest of North Africa, because Egypt is under the tripartite arrangement. So the rest of North Africa as well as West Africa, because the East and Southern Africa is covered under the tripartite FTA. And the AFCFTA in that way allows for coexistence of all of these regional arrangements. It's based on reciprocity and variable geometry, which means that we can move at different speeds when it comes to liberalization based on the capacity of the members to be able to make the commitments. Because what we don't want is to advocate for a literal AFCFTA that is going to undermine our industrial development objectives. So there is some reassurance or guarantee that we will ensure alignment between the market integration agenda as well as the industrial development agenda. It establishes a single rule book for trade as well as investment. Investment, competition, and intellectual property rights will be negotiated under phase two. So what we're looking at now in terms of phase one is the goods and services. If you look at the legal architecture, which has been negotiated and concluded, we have the agreement establishing the AFCFTA, as well as the protocol on trading goods, which effectively looks at how we are going to facilitate the movement of goods across the continent. It includes the schedule of tariff concessions, which are still to be negotiated, the rules of origin, which are the conditions, as I said, honorable members, that the product must meet for it to get preferential access, customs cooperation, which is led by SARS, as well as trade facilitation and transit. Those are all led by SARS because it's, it promotes cooperation between the customs authorities to facilitate efficiency when it comes to the movement of goods across borders. We also have an annex on the non-tariff barriers, because as you reduce tariffs, what happens is that members normally put in place the non-tariff barriers, whether it's regulatory barriers. So commitments have also been made on the non-tariff barriers. We do also note that there are measures that as countries we have access to, both in terms of the World Trade Organization commitments, which are the technical barriers to trade, to ensure that you are able to facilitate trade for products that meet the relevant standards. So we reserve the right to put the correct standards to safeguard our own market. Then we also have the annex on sanitary and phytosanitary measures. That looks at the animal and plant health and issues. So it's issues that are regulated by the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries to ensure that we are able to promote safe trade. So again, there, any member of the, or member state of the AFCFTA reserves the right as long as it is in line with international standards. And secondly, it is not used as a trade barrier. So we can put the necessary measures, including regulations that will safeguard the safety of the products that are traded within the continent. The last annex relates to the trade remedies. The trade remedies aim to deal with unfair trade because there are always unintended consequences to trade, where some of the countries may either dump the products, which means that they will sell the products at a lower price than they sell in their own domestic market, which will end up killing our own industry. So in that case, we reserve the right to impose anti-dumping measures or safeguard measures if there's a sudden surge in imports, or countervailing measures if there is a subsidization of the products. But in the region, normally, we don't have a challenge with subsidies. Subsidies are mainly originating from developed countries. We also have the protocol on trade and services that allows for or provide for disciplines for progressive liberalization when it comes to services. This is an area where we have an offensive interest as a country because we're quite competitive, and already without preferential access, we have our financial sector being visible in the rest of the continent, the telecommunications, construction is also an area where we have offences. So this will ensure that we are able to increase our exports of services to the rest of the continent. We also have a dispute settlement mechanism through the protocol on rules and procedures for the settlement of disputes, which is established similar to what we have in the WTO, which will ensure that we have a more efficient dispute settlement mechanism. As I said, Chair, under phase two, we'll discuss competition, intellectual property, and investment. So that will come at a later stage. There are currently 49 members, and South Africa is one of those that has signed the FTA in July. We didn't sign when it was launched in March because there were still annexes that were not completed. Our legal system requires that if we sign an agreement that it refers to specific annexes, and all of those must be there for our Department of Justice to look at and the Department of International Relations, the state law advisors to look at to satisfy themselves that whatever agreement we are signing, including these annexes, is in line with our domestic law, but also our international obligations. So we're only able to sign after all of those requirements were met. So far we have seven countries that have ratified. For the agreement to enter into force, you need 22 countries to deposit their instruments of ratification. So where we are now is that it is important for us that we are part of the 22. Because if we're not part of the 22, which is why we are now presenting this for ratification, if we're not part of the 22, we are going to join as an acceding member. And if you join as an acceding member, there are certain limitations because while you have not joined, you can't influence the negotiations on the areas that are currently under negotiation. So it will put us at a disadvantage and will be in the back foot. And as a major or one of the major economies in the continent, it's important that as we craft the AFCFTA, we are in the room and part of the members that will then come up with a complete architecture of the CFTA. In terms of the strategic importance, I think I've touched on this issue that it will give us additional market access, especially into West and North Africa. The benefits are the larger economies of scale and the bigger market, which improves our prospects as a continent to attract investment. But because we are looking at the developmental integration agenda, what we want to also encourage through the AFCFTA is to promote intra-Africa investment, not only investments from outside of the continent. Effectively, what the AFCFTA does is to give us a market of over 1 billion people, 1.2 billion to be precise, which is a market similar to China and India. So it is going to assist to spare industrial development. It has a GDP of approximately $3.3 trillion. The other advantage is that it gives us legal certainty and predictability of markets. It promotes a rules-based multilateral trading system because we will all have a similar trade regime when it comes to our trade in the continent. It also establishes a fair and impartial dispute resolution mechanism through the establishment of the panel. But most importantly, it will boost intra-Africa trade as the UNECA study shows. It will also contribute to a positive investment climate in the continent. There are potential threats, honorable members, but all of those have been addressed through the agreement. There is a possibility if we don't enhance our border environment or customs environment that there may be a possibility of the other countries being used as conduits for exports from other countries. So, but if we implement the rules of origin as they will be negotiated to promote intra-regional trade, then we can deal with that because it means that third country exports will not be able to meet those rules of origin because there must be local content. So for that reason, we will be able to mitigate that through the effective implementation of the rules of origin. The other issue is the potential for substandard products, but that will also be dealt with the fact that we have reserved our right to be able to implement any measures to deal with substandard products. So our national law, including the institutions, the standards institutions that we have, should be able to deal with that. In terms of customs revenue, there is an implication, but for us in South Africa, we don't use tariffs as instruments to raise revenue, but rather as instruments to promote industrial development. And customs revenue really doesn't account for a big share of our national revenue. I think it's around 7%. So for that reason, the biggest advantage would be, even though there is a loss, we can make up for that through the increase in exports to the rest of the region and the fact that we are able to export mainly value-added products. I've touched on the mitigation of the potential threats. We also have instruments that are inbuilt in the agreement itself. The trade remedies will assist with any unfair trade, but also SARs and the rules of origin will deal with the transshipment. The dispute settlement mechanism is quite efficient. We've separated it from the one we have in SADC, which was based on the tribunal, which sometimes leads to politicization of the issues. The one established under the CFTA is purely on trade and should be able to deal with the trade disputes. In terms of the implementation of the agreement, once it is ratified and once we meet the 22, and we have also negotiated the tariff concessions, SARS will be able to implement by ensuring that within the Customs and Excise Act there is a tariff schedule for the implementation of the AFCFTA. Also, we work very closely with other divisions of the DTI in terms of promotion of the agreement and identification of the opportunities that exist from the agreement so that we are able to leverage the opportunities thereof. We have also, honorable members, consulted quite widely, both interdepartmentally, the core departments, including DALF, have been consulted. Then on the legal aspects of the agreement, we have consulted with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, as well as DCO. As I've indicated, we also consult extensively through NEDLAC to ensure that we have a clear mandate upon which to base our position. And there are legal opinions from DCO and the DOJ that indicate that the agreement is in compliance with both the domestic law as well as our international obligations. So what we are presenting to the committee is to request that the committee support the ratification of the agreement because of the benefits that it will have for South Africa's own development objectives, but also the impact it will have on regional economic integration. And just to emphasize that the continent is quite strategic and is a strategic market for South Africa, given that already 30% of our exports are destined for the continent, and we are one of the biggest contributors to intra-Africa trade. So it is important that we are able to ratify and be part of the 22 members that will, once ratified, ensure that the agreement enters into force. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, TGG. Honourable members, the procedure is that it is presented to us. We, as a select committee, would have to interrogate what is presented to us first, and then we'll have to make a decision whether we refer it to the House or not. So it's open for further discussion. Honorable Kaula, Honorable Khai, Honorable Nsanga, in that sequence.
Okay, so I'm sitting in another committee next year. And I thought that I was going to see Mr. Klaus, and I see he's not here. He owes me something. I think the issues are are very clear to. So I think we have agreed to it. That's my vote before I move on. But I'm wondering, I don't understand why Ethiopia hasn't either fined or done what, because there is no instability in Ethiopia. And Ethiopia is one of the economies that are doing very well currently. They have overtaken us as number one airline in the continent, and the economy is doing well. I don't understand. There must be something behind that. Something else. Thank you.
Honorable Kola, we want to thank you. Honorable Kola, before you go, we want to thank you that you are helping us to get that one process. But there is the agreement on the protocol on finance and investment that we need to look at as well. Would you mind giving us 5 minutes that we have a presentation on that, and that we can then decide on both of
that? Just give you approval, you find the nickel.
If you will allow us on the behind
the
questions that were put to us were questions for clarity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
On the principle.
Right.
Okay. Can we, because of the procedure, can we ask you, DG, to look at the ratification of the agreement amending Annex 1 of the Cooperation on Investment of the SADC Protocol on Finance and Investment? We have received all these documents beforehand, so we have looked at them.
I'll hand over, as I said, to our Deputy Director General, who has been painfully involved in all these negotiations, and to hand over you to take the final one on the protocol on finance.
Thank you very much.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, the finance and investment protocol was acceded to by South Africa some time back. But what we are presenting now are amendments to Annex 1, which is the Cooperation on Investment Annex. The rationale for amending this is that due to the challenges related to the bilateral investment treaty, of which the original Annex 1 was based on, it allowed for or gave extensive rights to investors without really balancing those rights to the rights of governments to regulate in the public interest. Secondly, it provided for an investor-state dispute mechanism, which opened up a lot of governments, including South Africa, to being challenged by investors for regulating in the public interest. We had environmental laws that were challenged, labor laws that were challenged. In South Africa, investors mainly targeted our transformation law. So it became clear to all the regional countries that there is a problem with regards to Annex 1, and a number of countries globally are reforming and modernizing their investment policy. So really what we are doing with regards to the amendment of Annex 1 is to modernize and reform our own investment policy in the region. But it doesn't limit our right as a country to admit and regulate an investment. So if I go to the actual presentation, you've indicated, Honorable Chair, that you've looked at it, but really the purpose is to ensure that we harmonize investment policies within the region and address the challenges that indicated that were inherent in the bilateral investment treaties. What we've also done is to develop a model bid, which will be the basis for countries to then negotiate this in future if they so wish. What was clear to us was that prior to the amendment, there were broad definitions of investors and investment that really opened us up to legal challenge by the investors. So we are trying to address those risks. But also important, it provided for the most favored nation treatment according to foreign investors, which means that you must treat the investors the same and sometimes even give them better treatment than you would give your own investors. You would recall, honourable members, that in the Protection of Investment Act, we've dealt with this issue. So the amendment of Annex 1 tries to align what we have in the Protection of Investment Act with regards to our regional commitments when it comes to investment. As indicated, in terms of the challenges that we have, if we don't ratify the amendments of Annex 1, is that even though we've addressed the issues under the Protection of Investment Act, we will have or will be exposed under the original commitments that we've made under the original Annex 1. So we are trying to close that loophole. So we have consulted quite extensively, including with DECO, National Treasury, as well as the Department of Justice with regards to these amendments. Just to go through the amendments, it clarifies the definition of investment that will be protected and also ensures that we provide for what we call post-establishment rights, which means that the investment will only be admitted if it meets the laws of the host state, rather than to guarantee that regardless of whether the investment meets the conditions and the laws of the state, it must be admitted. So we are correcting that loophole. But also importantly, we define who the investor is and what type of investment will be protected. So speculative short-term investment is not going to be protected under this regime. So we're looking for real investment that is going to change the structure and contribute to our own development objectives. The most important issue is in Article 5. In Article 5, what we guaranteed under the annex was prompt and effective compensation when it comes to expropriation, which means that we guaranteed market value, which goes against Article 25 or Section 25 of the South African Constitution. So in the Annex 1 now, we provide for fair and adequate compensation, which is aligned to what we have in the Constitution. Then we also accord investors in terms of Article 6, national treatment instead of the most favored nation treatment, which means that you treat foreign investors the same way you are treating your own. We also reserve the right to regulate in the public interest. In the previous annex, we limited this right only to health, safety, and environmental concerns, but now we also expand it to include the developmental aspect. We have also amended what we had, which was to make provision for investor-state disputes. We now have state-to-state dispute settlement. This is in line with both the SADC protocol on the tribunal, which allows for a state-to-state dispute settlement mechanism rather than investor-state. And this is in line with global developments. In the new NAFTA, or what is now called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, the U.S. has also moved away from investor-state dispute to state-to-state dispute settlement mechanism. So it's a new development. There are a number of countries, including New Zealand, Australia, that are also looking at state-to-state dispute settlement. This is also in line with what we provide for in the Protection of Investment Act, where we say investors can access our domestic courts. If they so wish, we can consider, if they go to their home state, we can consider a state-to-state arbitration. So effectively, Honourable Chair, what these amendments do is to ensure that there's alignment between the Finance Investment Protocol in SADC as well as the Protection of Investment Act, and the amendment is needs to be ratified in terms of Section 232, Paragraph 2 of the South African Constitution, and it is in conformity with all our laws. It has been confirmed by both the DOJ as well as the court. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, DJ. Honourable Kaula.
No, thanks. Two things. What will be the implication of should the amendment to the Constitution happen in the direction that it is right now taking? Should it happen, what will be its implication to Article 5? Secondly, I see just one objection. I see you have confused your letter to AFIP, which would have started with I. you can we do to support them?
Thank you very much. Honourable members, just a procedural issue. We have the principal support of the Honourable Kawula. If you will allow me to then put before you that the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations, having considered the request for, for approval by Parliament on the agreement amending Annex 1 on cooperation and investment of the SADC Protocol on Finance and Investment, including Protocol on Finance and Investment, recommends that the House, that's the NCOP, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, approves the said agreement. Can I have a proposer or a seconder or opposition to that? Honourable Khai?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm seconding Honourable Kawula.
You second the Honourable Kawula. Thank you very much. Honourable Ntele?
Mine is just clarity.
We have agreed that we will raise the questions after we've adopted.
Yeah, it doesn't affect whether the adoption of
can we just hold there so that I deal with the other one? Then we will give you an opportunity to raise the questions. Honourable members, I then put before you the ACFTA. The Select Committee on Trade and International Relations, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the agreement establishing the African Continental Free Trade Area, ACFTA, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Is there any opposition to that, or do we have a agreement?
Second, Honourable Kawula.
You second, Honourable Kawula. Thank you very much. Okay. Now we are at the stage where we can engage with both the presentations at the same time. There were the questions raised by Honourable Kawula. Please note them. We'll take a few more before we respond. Honourable Ntebe, you have the floor, sir.
No, Chair. Mine is it's a small one. If you go to Article 5, which seeks to give effect to what we anticipate to be coming, I just want to get clarity as to probably you see when you write law, you don't want to wait off ambiguous because if you have a word like adequate, it's subjective. To what extent do you determine adequacy? And if we leave such words in the amendment, we are open ourselves for challenge in court, and adequacy can be contested by anybody, because what is adequate to me might not be adequate to the DG. And it could have been better if the Article 5 object could have said compensation related to expropriation shall be fair, so that at least you leave it. But if you include the words like adequacy, I think I've made my point. However, I'm not calling for amendments now. I'm just saying in future, because recently the intention is to contest everything, and especially when you talk about issues that are going to be affecting people that we know already that they are contesting the object of the agreement. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you, Chair. I must appreciate the presentation. It's very informative, Chair. Some of the things, maybe some of us were not aware of. I'll only go direct here to what is this slide? Six. Slide number six, Chair, on your capital. Okay. On the ratification of the agreement established by the African Trade Continental Level. The Chair, we are talking, we are saying here, let me go to the page number six. Well, there is this UN ICA, né? That it always recommends to whatever that must be done in Africa. My question is just for interest sake. I know that some of these questions, they may need the political, maybe there are, of course, political, they may need the minister to answer them. The question is, you see, when we are in the UN and in all these other forums, we are told of institutional reform and all these other issues. The question is, what is the UN, the UN ICA doing in terms of developing Africa per se? Apart from recommending that go and do institutional reforms, go and do this and this, what are they doing to empower the Africa as it is in terms of the development? That was my first question, Chair. And the other one, on your answer, you said 18% that we get as Africa. The question, why? Because most of these goods are that are important. I mean, we have so much mineral that we take out of the country. Why do we have, leave South Africa alone, Africa as a whole? Why are we having this 18%? What caused this Africa to then have 18% out of the whole comparative analysis, on your comparative analysis, why are we getting this 18%? What causes us to get this 18%? What should we do to pick up? Then the other one, Chair, is now you have 31.2 on the slide 8, 31.92 billion of investment. Now, out of these investments that you are mentioning here, or treaties or whatever that you, your agreements that you went and signed.
What page are you on, Dr. Mufana?
Page 8, slide number 8.
Page
8? Yeah, boosting intra-Africa trade. The question is, I understand that you're talking of Africa, but I mean in terms of integration, we're not focusing only in Africa. We also talk of the continent. Now my question will be, do we, among this, for this, it's 478.8 billion for 2017, do we also count deals that are made or treaties or agreements that are signed between ourselves and particularly the in Europe, the the United Arab Emirates? Does this involve there is some of those treaties that are, or actually is this money part of, I don't know how would I say this question now, let me rephrase it, is this package inclusive with Europe, or it's only focusing Africa, particularly with the United Arab Emirates? There's a reason why I'm asking that. And then, the other one, on goods that we export, is that an interest? I mean, I'm having a serious interest on this question. On your minerals, let me quickly go to gold. Do we import gold as raw or processed?
Import.
Check. Yes. And that is another thing that I wanted to know, your steel. Because so far I remember that in South Africa there was industrial espionage. There was industrial espionage that took place in South Africa. Currently we don't manufacture much steel in South Africa. Now, with these minerals that we have to manufacture this steel, is it imported as raw as it is, or what is happening about the steel in South Africa? Because I mean, we're one of the biggest countries in Africa that manufactures steel, and we had it observed more labor intensive. Today we are having a challenge. There's no steel. I think those will be more confident. Yeah, but your 13, slide number 13. cannot be taken into confidence, Chair. I think. But, let me leave this one because you gave us the annexure on the detail there. Let me leave this one because I wanted to get the details. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Khan. Thank you very much, Honorable Secretary. I'm just worried about the number of countries that have ratified so far. I think you said 7, so it will be the 8 next week, after next week, depending on when then the government is processing the ratification. Yes, we're still far from getting to 22, but also the out of 49. I remember at some stage there also on TV, but they kept on repeating this thing there on 404. The president persuading Nigeria to sign the agreement. I wanted to check if they finally signed the agreement. what's the point of having these regional structures if you finally going to have the CFTA? Because what is it that is different that these regional structures are going to do, which is not being done by the continental structure? The third point is I tell you that there is going to be institutional arrangement to monitor the implementation. What are the financial implications of that institutional arrangement or institutional structure that is going to monitor? The issues of, we were talking when we're dealing with the DTI annual report, the trade imbalances between three countries and South Africa. How are we going to address, because you were indicating that South Africa is a dominant economically in the continent. So how do we deal with that, the situation where we tilt with the imbalances in terms of trade? I think linked to that is this issue of the value-added products. First, that also goes to the issue of the South Africa and the BRICS trade. Because I take it that when we talk about value-added products or export, we're referring to issues of beneficiation. And we've been using this term for years, but we don't actually do it. What is stopping us from doing it? Those are the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, Musanga, if you can be quick, please.
Yeah, I don't have that one, Chair. It's also for the interesting. Why are we overcharging for customer union? Why not free trade area? Why not economic community area? It's just a very interesting question. Because whatever you opt for here, it limits your bargaining or your negotiation of power. If you have to have shoes for your what you call the free trade area, which I don't think we spoke about, meaning we determine our tariffs, they determine their tariffs. Now the question is, why do we choose free trade area than preferential trade? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we do have an apology from the DG. You have a difficulty when you have a very hard-working minister who arrives in the morning and goes into a cabinet meeting and suddenly realizes that he's not consulted with his functionaries, and he had to call the DG to come. And we know the DG is participating, assisting the ministers in the cabinet meeting, and he had to run there and take some of the other staff with him as well.
So apologies from those that had to leave us. But did you?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Maybe with regards to Ethiopia, I guess joining a regional economic community or a preferential arrangement is a sovereign decision. So countries would look at their level of development, their national objectives, and then decide what or when is it appropriate to join. So that is the case when it comes to Ethiopia. They fully participate in the TFTA negotiations. They are fully participating in the AFTFTA negotiations. But I think at the appropriate time they will probably sign. But it's difficult to say when and what informs it. But yes, it is based on their own development objectives and the mandate that the negotiators have. Then I will deal with both the question that was raised by Honorable Kaula as well as Honorable Ntebe with regards to the impact of the expropriation about compensation and the discussions that have taken place and what we mean by fair and adequate compensation. If Honorable Members look at Article 5 of the Annex 1, we have, I think even before the discussion started, we ensured that we don't close the policy space for a country to determine for itself. What is entailed in paragraph 2 of Article 5 is that the assessment of fair and adequate compensation shall be based on an equitable balance between the public interest and the interest of those affected, having regard for all relevant circumstances, and taking account of the current and past use of the property, the history of its acquisition, the fair market value of the investment, the purpose of the expropriation, the extent of previous profit made by the foreign investor through the investment, and the duration of the investment. So the number of factors that will have to be considered by a country to determine what we mean by fair and adequate. So you have to take into account the purpose and what is the public interest. So it's not that you will just pay what the investor deems adequate. You have to look at all of those in making that determination. Then the role of the UNECA. The UNECA, as you correctly indicate, Honorable Tebe, does provide technical advice and input into the regional integration processes that we have, including providing regulatory advice with regard to the investment and economic climate to countries. So that is their role. So in that way, they do make a contribution because they are supposed to look at these issues from a developmental perspective rather than to say these are the reforms that you must make without taking due regard of one, the national priorities of countries, the regional priorities, but also the developmental impact. But of course, like any technical input or advice, what we always do, at least in South Africa and of course other members or member states of the continent, is to look at the appropriateness of that advice in the context of the agenda that you are pursuing. So, but they do provide a very good service when it comes to our regional integration processes. Then on the question as to why intra-Africa trade is low and is standing at 18%, the reason for that is that we are producing similar products. So we mainly, as African countries, producers of minerals and agricultural products. So the potential to trade amongst ourselves is limited by that, which is why we are advocating for this development integration agenda, that you should not only talk about negotiating preferential arrangements without addressing the productive capacity constraints. Because the only way we'll be able to increase intra-Africa trade is if we diversify our productive structures, if we beneficiate and then South Africa sells
a beneficiated product or Lesotho sell the beneficiated product, then the potential to trade amongst ourselves increases. So the fact that we're able to, between 2009 and 2015, double is because of the efforts that we have implemented to try and change that structure of trade. Then with regards to the 478 billion, this is trade, our trade in goods, and it's goods only. So merchandise trade of South Africa with the rest of the continent. It doesn't include what happens with other countries beyond the continent. But what we have also indicated is that through the African Continental Free Trade Area, there's a potential to even increase that further, because if you look at which region accounts for majority of that trade, it is SACCO and SADC, because of the preferential arrangements we have. But if we are able to have preferential arrangements beyond SADC, including through in West and North Africa, then the opportunities will be much greater for South Africa, and there's a potential to even double that in future. Because if you look at the other regions, they trade more amongst themselves than with external parties. So that is what we want to correct through this arrangement. So it does not include your UAEs, it's just merchandise trade within the continent. When it comes to minerals, and I'll also deal with the iron and steel, yes, we do export some raw materials, but mostly our exports are beneficiated. Hence, I indicated that 63% of our exports are value-added products. So even when it comes to those minerals and iron and steel, it's your bars, it's your rods, it's your coils, so beneficiated products. But the point that you have raised around Honorable Tebe on iron and steel and the fact that we've lost over time our productive capacity on steel, it is correct. We are currently having a challenge globally with overcapacity on steel production. This is one of the issues that has resulted in these trade tensions, especially between China and the U.S. We are also negatively affected by that, and there is globally a multilateral forum through the G20 that has been established to deal with the overcapacity of steel production, so that at the end of the day we ensure that we are able to maintain or even protect the steel capacity that exists at a national level. We have also, as the DTI, have implemented measures to protect our steel sector. There has been an increase in the duty for imported steel into the country up to the maximum bound rate that were allowed in the WTO. But also through the Industrial Development Division, there is support that has been provided, including the establishment of a steel forum to look at also how do we address our own domestic challenges when it comes to steel. And to a certain extent, it has also assisted to avert further job losses in the steel sector and stabilize the sector. When it comes to why are we negotiating a free trade area, not a customs union, or not a preferential trade agreement? One, as a country, we've taken a conscious decision to say, and you're correct when you say a free trade area allows a country to set its own tariffs. So you can look at your own development objectives, industrial development objectives, and then decide what level of tariffs we need to set. And we've decided to adopt a developmental approach to tariffs. It's on a case-by-case on the basis of the investigations that are undertaken by the International Administration Commission of South Africa, ITEC. So we have only joined one customs union, which is SACCO, and it is also historical. but I think it was in 2012 when there was a discussion whether we should also advance SADC beyond an FTA into a customs union. As a country, we took a conscious decision to say, if you look at the continent and the countries in the continent, there is what we call the spaghetti bowl, where you have proliferation of rats, one. Secondly, you have a number of countries belonging to more than one rat. And countries belong to a rat for specific purposes. Some is for political reasons and security reasons. The others is for economic reasons. So it becomes very difficult to force a country to say choose this rat and not the other. Because the moment you move to a customs union, you have what you call a common external tariff, so which means the members within that regional community must charge one tariff vis-a-vis products that are coming from third parties. Amongst yourselves, you have free movement, but for products coming from outside of the rat, you have one tariff. So for that reason, if you force members to choose, it means that they must leave South Africa and the SACU countries must leave SACU if we want to establish a customs union in SADC, and we must choose SADC. And those that are belonging in SADC and COMESA must choose between COMESA and SADC. So effectively, it becomes a zero-sum game. And it doesn't assist us to address some of the fundamental reasons why countries belong to those reasons. Because I don't think a country takes it for granted to join a region because of specific objectives. So to avoid forcing countries to go that route, and also what is difficult is that already some are at a customs union level. You have SACU at a customs union, you have the East African community at a customs union, you have COMESA that has launched a customs union but is not yet implemented. So effectively what it would mean is that you must harmonize all of these external, common external tariffs to come up with one set of a tariff nomenclature, which becomes difficult for members because we're at different levels of development. So to avoid that zero-sum game, what becomes practical as a regional integration agenda is to promote broadening of integration through FTA, so the tripartite, the continental, rather than deepening within a REC and form a customs union or economic community. So that is the rationale for the FTAs that we have, and it's in line with South Africa's strategy for the continent. Then the difference between an FTA and a PTA is that the PTA is a limited agreement. So if we want to really promote intra-Africa trade, we need a comprehensive agreement that covers a number of tariff lines. What we have agreed now in the AFCFTA is that we need to have at least 90% coverage of the tariff line so that we really promote intra-Africa trade, because and a PTA can even have 1,000 tariff lines, which will not really provide meaningful market preferential access. So that is why we've opted for an FTA. Then the number of countries that have ratified, yes, it's 7. Actually, we've moved, Honorable Khai, at a huge speed. If you look at ratifications of international instruments, it takes time, sometimes years. But with the CFTA, first of all, you have a huge number of countries that are signing. The fact that you have 49 out of 55 is a huge progress on its own, which shows political commitment into the process. Then within, not even within a year, because the year will end in March 2019, you already have 7. And a number of countries are going through their own internal legal processes to ratify. So it's really moving at an enormous speed. And I'm not surprised why it is moving at the speed it does, because of what is happening globally with trade. That you have, especially our traditional markets, becoming more protectionist, either through increases in tariffs or through the non-tariff barriers, especially the use of sanitary and phytosanitary measures for our agricultural exports. So it means that the only alternative that we have as African countries is trade amongst ourselves. So there's more urgency now, even though you had the Lagos Action Plan and all of that in the past, there's now more urgency and value that members see in having a bigger regional market within the continent. Nigeria, with regards to Nigeria, the core challenge is that some of the countries do not have national mechanisms or platforms for consultation. Unlike us, because we have NEDLAC, where we consult with civil society, and they are up to speed about what we are negotiating, what are the issues, and they give their views, which we advance as government. So they've always been part of the process. So what was clear in the Nigerian case was that it seems that there was lack of consultation. So Nigeria has indicated to us in bilateral discussions that they had to go throughout Nigeria, the rest of the country, to engage as much as they can with all the stakeholders to explain what the AfCFTA is, what will it provide, what are the benefits for Nigeria, what are the risks and the threats, so that everyone is brought up to speed. So, and the president has also established a committee consisting of a multi-stakeholder committee that will advise the country as to the mandate with regards to the future. But we understand that they have concluded the consultation process, so it should be a matter of time before, of course, they do join. But there is an intention to join the process. Then what is the point of the regional structure? I think I've partly responded to it, that countries belong to RECs for different reasons. So there will still be value for us in belonging to SADC, there will still be value for us in belonging to SACU, but what we need to ensure is that the RECs do not undermine the AfCFTA ultimately. There's an alignment. So over time, there may be harmonization of what happens in the AfCFTA and the RECs. And actually, the rules of origin that are being negotiated, we are using the RECs as the basis to ensure that at the end of the day there will be free movement. So, as I said, because we are talking about the free trade agreement, a country can sign as many free trade agreements as possible. So there's no conflict in terms of the free trade arrangement we have in SADC and the free trade arrangement we have in the TFTA and beyond. So legally, it's possible to do that. With regard to the institutional arrangement, there will be a secretariat that will be established to monitor the implementation of the agreement. In terms of the size and the budget, those issues are still to be discussed. But what has been agreed is that it must be a technical secretariat, not political, because you need to ensure that we are able to have the relevant skills in the implementation of a trade agreement. So there are some parameters that have been agreed, but the size of the secretariat, where it will be, all of those issues are still to be discussed, including because the size will be, I mean, the budget will depend on the size. With regards to the imbalances, you are correct, Honorable Kai, that what you complain about with regards to BRICS is what others complain against us because we have an increasing surplus. It's only a few countries where we have a deficit, Angola, for example, because of imports of oil. So there's a growing trade surplus, which is a concern, and many countries have also indicated that they want to industrialize. So they don't want to be used by South Africa as markets of our products, and they are not able to also beneficiate or add value to their own product. Hence, we then said it's important to not only have or follow the linear integration model that talks about deepening. So you establish an FTA, then after that customs union, after that an economic community, after that a political union. That is not important if you look at where we are in terms of level of development. So the focus is really to look at the development of regional value chains, because in that way you'll be promoting complementarity between countries rather than competition. So we can, for example, supply mineral to a specific country, they beneficiate and export to us, and vice versa. So that's the type of agenda that we are trying to pursue. The other issue is that we had to refine our own strategy. As much as we are saying the BRICS countries must refine their strategy vis-a-vis South Africa and focus more on the investment-led strategy, we also have to do the same. So we've established within the DTI Trade Invest Africa. That division aims to promote outward investment into the other countries so that we focus on improving productive capacity and support those countries in their own industrial development program. In that way, they'll be able to move up the value chain and export products to South Africa. We already see benefits the impact of that, in that while our exports into the rest of the continent have increased, we have also increased our imports into South Africa from the rest of the region, although it's still mainly primary products. So that is the way we are trying to deal with the trade imbalance. The other issue is that we also need to look at where we are in the value chain. That in some cases and in some sectors, because of where the other countries are, South Africa may need to move up the value chain. For example, if we're talking about clothing and textile, which is always a contentious issue in the negotiations, the other countries are saying, the sector in which we can have immediate productive capacity is clothing and textile. So South Africa, it may mean that South Africa may look at niche production of niche clothing and textile products to leave the space for example, t-shirts and simple production and methods to be produced elsewhere. So those are the discussions that are unfolding when we talk about the development of this country. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. You've done justice to all the questions. Let me, in conclusion, honorable members, just make the following quick remarks. The one is that for you to convey this to the DG, you said we are not manufacturing locomotives. We are. Particularly yesterday, the President also, when he answered questions in the National Assembly, mentioned the new plant in Danota, which is now fully operational, and it relates to this transatlantic trade because President is saying that already there is a lot of interest from other countries in Africa. I know I have heard some people from the Democratic Republic talking about the need for them to have locomotives within the DRC in those areas where you can travel. Because we know it's very difficult to travel around in the DRC. That's one. The second is, honourable members, it's a pity honourable Kai is not yet, because I particularly wanted to throw this at him. We have a responsibility to make sure that we share these developments and legislation and agreements with our provinces, so that our companies in the province can position themselves. Like the ones that I've mentioned now, the young men from Harankua. I've had another young man here from the Western Cape calling me and saying, but I want to participate in an international mission. You know, that DTI's website is there, but many people don't know. So we have to do that work within our provinces to make sure. Otherwise, we're going to be left out. The third and final thing that I just wanted to say is that what particularly excites me about this is when we participate in the last meeting of the plenary, the planning committee of the WTO. We had at least three African countries other than South Africa participating in that. And it demonstrated two things to me. The one is how we are positioned in the WTO. And the other is how much the African countries depend on the advocacy work in the international fora on how sharp we are in terms of engaging with that. We, for example, had the ambassador of Nigeria to the WTO. We have ambassadors to the WTO. Mm-hmm. And we had the ambassador of Nigeria answering the questions that you're raising about when Nigeria is going to sign, because somebody raised it in the forum meeting. And he had the typical diplomatic answer to the question. But I want to conclude on a lighter note on Ntebe and say that when you look at the use of the word adequate in Annex 5, you should go to these WTO meetings. You sit there for hours and just debate one word and having to choose which is the most appropriate word to use. So to commend ourselves that we're looking at that, but to say that within the development of trade policies and agreements, a lot of energy is consumed by finding the exact word to protect. Not that we are announcing protectionism, but to make sure that the agreements that we draft are not abused by anybody. So thank you very much, honourable members. We have come to the end of our meeting at the time that we anticipated. We want to again reiterate our appreciation to the DTI for accommodating us earlier so that we could do justice to the two agreements as well as the policy.